This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Matt Piper in New York. For the second time in just a few days, a plane carrying migrants arrived in Sacramento. Now, California officials say they are investigating if Florida paid for the private planes, as KOVR-TV's Madison Keevy reports.
They say they are investigating to see if these migrants on both flights were misled or were told they were going somewhere else or promised a destination different to where they were going, ending up here in Sacramento. We've also since learned that the White House has been in talks with our state DOJ.
The Chinese military has engaged in unsafe and unprofessional maneuvers that have nearly led to collisions with an American fighter plane and a U.S. ship. Those dour words from the U.S. military today.
The latest incidents involving close encounters with U.S. fighter jets and warships are part of what the White House calls a pattern of growing aggressiveness on China's part. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says someone could eventually get hurt.
When you have pieces of metal that size, whether it's in the air or on the sea, and they're operating that close together, it wouldn't take much for an error in judgment or a mistake to get made.
China accuses the U.S. of provocation and urges Washington to mind its own business. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, the White House.
We've learned that the pilot of the private plane that flew over Washington and crashed in Virginia yesterday appeared to be slumped over and unresponsive. That is what the pilots of U.S. fighter jets reported. Sheriff Donald Smith of Augusta County, Virginia, says the investigation is just beginning because the plane is in a mountainous area.
We had our drones and we were able to, we kind of relied on the Virginia State Police to help us. Their aviation unit came in and they helped us with their helicopters and their aviation division locate where we needed to go.
To the war in Ukraine, with attacks by Ukraine against Russian forces yesterday near the decimated city of Bakhmut, there is now speculation that the military under President Volodymyr Zelensky is launching a spring offensive. More from the BBC's Frank Gardner.
They're probably going to start with events like what we've just seen, small probing attacks, not committing their full forces, just prodding the Russians here and there, testing their defenses.
There are more than 400 wildfires burning across Canada, impacting air quality as far south as Virginia. Emergency Preparedness Minister Bill Blair on CTV says thousands have had to flee their homes.
An estimated 26,000 people remain evacuated from their homes across the country.
In fact, firefighters are coming from France and the United States to help our neighbors to the north. This is CBS News.
Need hires who dazzle without the hassle? You need Indeed. Their powerful platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
Here's what you need to know in Western Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Cuska. A 42-year-old New Richmond man was shot and killed by law enforcement Saturday in the town of Star Prairie. According to a release from the St. Croix County Sheriff's Office, the man was inside of a home with a woman and two children and was seen holding a hunting rifle and was making threats towards officers. He was shot and killed by a sheriff's deputy and a New Richmond police officer when he came outside of the home. The shooting is under investigation by the Polk County Sheriff's Office and the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Every county in Wisconsin except for far northwestern Wisconsin is under an air quality advisory through midnight. Air quality index numbers for Eau Claire and La Crosse counties, the only two tracked by the DNR in the western part of the state, were in the red or unhealthy zone, according to the DNR. This means that people should limit their time outdoors today, especially children or people with certain health conditions. And Eau Claire Memorial, Amory, and Glenwood City are all competing this afternoon in the first day of the WIAA State Boys Golf Championship in Kohler, Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
So much waiting for me. Yeah, I wanna go outside. I wanna be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast. There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
The person in a taco place, we want the rights for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Go back to a day where, you know, I was saying this, you know, the other day, that there used to be waiter and waitress unions. Yeah. There used to be, you know, insurance unions. There used to be every different work had a union to represent their interests.
Yeah.
And I think we're kind of in a moment, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I think we're kind of in a moment where, you know, people are looking at what's happened with the economy, how, you know, we're creating a whole lot of have-nots and a few haves. And people are looking at it going, hey, we should be getting some of this. We should be doing better. We shouldn't have to struggle as hard to make ends meet. Yeah, I want a job. I just don't want three or four of them.
Yeah, what you're looking at is like Local One. You want people that are in the service industry that have one job and that pays them enough to cover your bills, your rent. You don't want to work 20,000 jobs to cover that.
But that battle cry that came out of here, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will. You should be able to, in this country, in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, at its wealthiest moment, you should be able to get by on 8 hours of work so that you can enjoy your life. That, you know, I go back to a friend from years and years ago. He was from Romania, and he said he came to this country so that he could work to live. That the work that he did paid for his life, not live to work, which is what it was like in Romania. He woke up every day and his only existence was to work every day. Work, 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 work. And that was it.
Yeah.
So for me, this is that moment, that pitch for the 8-hour day, that pitch for dignity and respect. This is that moment, I think.
And like here in Chicago, you got that. Other parts of the United States, you don't. The southern states, you got people out there just making the minimum. You know, we left in 67, the Great Migration.
Yeah.
And people, I just heard that somebody's telling me that a journeyman in Texas is making like $20-something an hour.
Wow.
And we're making $48, $49 an hour in our trade. That's why my dad left in 67. We haven't turned back. We've been here since.
Yeah, I talk about my story all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were poor. We were dirt poor by American standards. And in just my lifetime, I've gone from poverty to living in a solidly middle-class existence. I've led a life, and I've said this a million times, that I could have never imagined. And it has everything to do with that union card I carry in my wallet.
Yeah.
Because, look, I could have worked just as hard, and I know a lot of people who do, and still not have the ability to share in the wealth that my labor creates. And that, to me, is why the unions are so important. Also, it gave me a sense of empowerment, a voice on the job and a voice in society that you can stand up and say no without fear of, hey, I'm going to be fired or ostracized or worse. To me, this is why this is so important.
That's exactly why we want to work. We want to pass the Workers' Right Amendment to protect the workers. If he sees something wrong on a job site, safety-wise, he can report it without any reprisals.
No, I mean, look, as a painter working on these bridges and working on these windmills and working on things, you're not in great.
No.
This isn't the corner office. No. This isn't neat and tidy kind of work. This is dangerous stuff where safety matters. And if you don't have the ability to say, I don't think that's the right thing to do. Yeah.
And if we pass it, you'll be protected. We're in a sea of red. Illinois is the blue dot all around us.
Yeah.
And we need to keep it blue, and we need to make everything else blue around us.
No, I'm right there with you. Now, you're the president of LaCala, the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. This is one of these moments where you go, this is a division. And sadly, what happens to us is we get pitted against each other. I want everyone to do well. Explain to me what you guys do, why it's important, and what your goals are.
Well, Labor Council for Latin American Advancement is an arm of the AFL-CIO, the Illinois AFL-CIO, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. And we reach out for our Hispanic brothers and sisters. You don't have to be Hispanic to be part of LACLA. It's open to everybody. Given that the voice to the person that, like you said, is afraid to say something, we're here to advocate for them. And that's what it is. We bring people into the labor movement.
Yeah, for me, the idea is bringing people together. Doesn't matter. You know, as a kid, like I said, I grew up in a predominantly black housing project. The one thing that I knew when I learned very young, there's only one color that matters.
Yeah.
It's only just one color. It wasn't black and white. No. It was green. And the fact of the matter is we didn't have it. We were all broke.
Yeah.
And for me, this is all about making sure that we have the opportunity for people to lead better lives, to make the next generation better off than we were, and to leave something good behind. It doesn't get any more simple than that, does it?
Yeah, for our kids, correct.
Absolutely. But Jose, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with
us.
Thank
you, sir.
I'll take it a little time. Good stuff. Jose Acala, he is the president of Painters Local 184 here in Chicago, also LACLA president. Check out the work that they do. We'll get links out on social media how you can find them. IUPAT.org, the international site. You want to check out more of what the Painters Union does. Going to take a quick break back here from Chicago, broadcasting from our studios at WCPT AM 820, our radio affiliate here. Quick break, right back.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Again, here in Chicago, as we're talking about, you know, the history of what it took to build the 8-hour day, what it took to build the most prosperous working class in history, I have the eye towards the future and what needs to happen. And this workers' rights amendment here, again, can be that springboard, that you know, that thing that, you know, that sweeps across the country. Because, look, the attacks recently have kind of sprung out of here as well with the Janus decision and the assault on public sector workers and their ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and opportunity. And that's why I've asked Lauren Targos to come talk with us. Lauren is the Executive Vice President of Professional Labor with AFGE Local 704. Lauren, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
This is, you know, obviously the birthplace of the Janus decision and all of the attacks that happened on public sector workers. And you, as the Executive Vice President of Professional Labor, you've got to see those attacks happening, as we speak.
Absolutely. And, you know, Biden is certainly, you know, a welcome change from President Trump. But, he still can do more to make sure that all workers are, you know, feeling it from, especially in the federal government, that management is being welcoming to labor instead of antagonistic. We haven't seen that yet, at least in the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yep. And we've got future workers in the background saying, yes, we need to have better rights, because really it is about the future, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, I have my 3-month-old in the background here, and it's definitely given, it's my first kids, and so it's definitely given me a better perspective on why this fight is so important, you know, right now, because these are future workers. And, you know, the labor of creating those workers is certainly it's not taken into account in these contracts either.
And congratulations on triplets. So I'm sure everyone's going, why are there babies crying in the background? Because you're surrounded by children.
That's right. Triplets.
And this is one of those moments where you should be highlighting, you know, the fact that how hard it is for working mothers to be able to pursue their career and to be able to raise children and to be in this kind of moment, no?
Yeah, definitely. It's been very enlightening to be, especially talking to mothers of triplets. You know, I'm in these groups where all these triplet moms are juggling everything. And, you know, these babies are going to one day, you know, be the engine who creates profit, be the doctors for when we're elderly or the nurses when we're elderly. And we need to make sure that, you know, we're not putting all the labor to nurture them on the backs of one exasperated woman.
And it sounds like you are almost to that point. Now, you know, we were just in Scranton here recently where, you know, the sad reality is we're sending children in the mines 100 years ago. Can you imagine looking into your children's eyes and knowing that their future is, you know, in a coal mine somewhere at 5 or 6 years old?
It's remarkably cruel. And, you know, workers today are still fighting to overcome that history. And so it's so important for us to, you know, be teaching our children what the workers before us have overcome and know that the fight hasn't ended until, you know, we are winning the full fruits of our labor.
Now, you know, of course, you know, here in Illinois, you had a former governor who was someone who wanted to continue and accelerate that attack on workers by not just taking the bad no rights at work agenda statewide. They wanted to do it county by county and municipality by municipality, any way to attack your ability to support your family and to do better. They're all on board with.
That's right. Yeah. And they succeed sometimes in dividing workers from their own interests and dividing workers from seeing the solidarity in their fellow workers and saying, oh, those workers are different. And that's why they don't deserve the rights that you want for your family.
But
so it's important for us as we're fighting for this Workers' Rights Amendment to, you know, recognize that all around us we see workers and, you know, there may be different types of exploitation in different industries, but, you know, only in solidarity can we overcome, you know, the exploitation in each of our industries.
Yeah. Now, as Executive Vice President of Professional Labor with AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, you see these attacks firsthand. And there's been an all-out assault on government workers, on people who get up every day and do things for we the people and help us, you know, get the things we need and, you know, do the jobs that have to be done. Tell me what that makes you think, what that makes you feel when you see that.
It definitely makes me, you know, disillusioned. All the problems that we have in our society right now, you know, climate change and, you know, so much. I'm happened to be reading this book on emotional intelligence and seeing how, you know, all the violence we see in our communities, from young children to affecting older adults, you know, all of that is the labor of public sector workers. You know, government employees are the environmental protection agencies are going to be on the front line of fighting climate change. And teachers and social support workers in our schools are the folks who are nurturing our next generation. And, you know, I'd be remiss to not mention, you know, all the turmoil that teachers are dealing with in our schools right now. Health workers, you know, public sector workers are the essential workers holding up such important, critical aspects of our society right now. And it's a crime to not give us full access to our workers' rights as we are, you know, holding up this guy right now.
Yeah, but again, it's this division between public sector and private sector that the wealth class seems to again be honing in on to divide working people. Do you see a division? Do you see a difference? Do you see a division there?
I mean, there's certainly, they try to portray a difference, but, you know, I see, you know, the mine workers who are being completely ignored, the warehouse workers, those are all private sector workers who are absolutely entitled to the fruits of their labor, just as public sector workers are. And so it's important for us to, you know, the United States, you know, is a capitalist country. And so even in the public sector, you know, in my job at the Environmental Protection Agency, I'm encouraged sometimes to think of the people I serve as customers. That's the language that's been given in some of our trainings. And so, you know, it's public sector, private sector, the boss is still, you know, the people who benefited from the Citizens United decision at the Supreme Court. This is all about, you know, profit over people, and workers in the public sector and private sector are fighting to put people over profit and so that their children can, you know, not have to go into whatever metaphorical minds they create in the future.
No, that's an excellent point. So last question I've got for you, you know, as you're looking at this workers' rights amendment, what's the message for people on both sides, the private sector, the public sector, or people who aren't in unions at all? What's the message to them?
You know, especially for folks who aren't in unions at all, I hope, you know, and I think all workers are seeing this, even in work in industries that aren't being unionized. They're organizing, they're talking to each other, they're pushing for the boss to, you know, change their working conditions, even if they aren't formalized into a union just yet. But they're seeing the benefits and the importance of having organized labor in their workplaces. And so this amendment is this is critical to vote yes. Every single worker needs to vote yes, so that workers in Illinois can set the standard for, you know, the country on what it means for workers to live a life, to work to live, not live to work. You know, the way rent is going up with inflation and, you know, the burdens on workers right now are overwhelming. And I think you'll see that in the public sector and the private sector. And so, you know, we need to be talking to our neighbors. And I know in an individualistic society, that's something that's difficult to do. But, you know, now we're going into an election. It's a great time to talk to your neighbor, someone you haven't talked to before, and connect with them on what their life is like as a worker. And you'll find a lot of commonalities and, you know, a reason to vote yes on this workers' right amendment.
One of those things that hopefully will bring us back together. But Laureen, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Laureen Targus, she is AFGE Local 704's Executive Vice President of Professional Labor. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Follow us on the Working Class Heroes Tour. Right back from here in Chicago at WCPT Studios, AM 820. Back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
So what's the requirements when you lost everything?
Floridians devastated by Hurricane Ian confront a housing shortage and mold. Extreme heat and drought could render regions uninhabitable within decades, says United Nations. Plus,
the fact is, they're ripping you off.
California weighs a windfall profits tax on oil industry price gouging.
All of those ripoffs and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
President Biden spoke next, and it was a heartwarming speech about unity, recovery, and strength. But I got to point out, at no point did he throw paper towels into a desperate crowd, raising the troubling question, is Biden too old to ricochet a roll of brawny off a pensioner's noggin?
Coming up next on Fox News, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know the media already want to move on, but the scale of the damage in Florida is staggering.
Yes, it is. Now, the search has ended for survivors of Hurricane Ian. The storm destroyed or damaged hundreds of thousands of homes, deepening the existing affordable housing crisis in the state, with many thousands now homeless, including a significant number of elderly retirees. Mm. The daunting task of cleanup has underscored another emerging factor, toxic mold, that is setting in at water-damaged properties. Mm. The New York Times reports that mold is actually a growing problem across the entire country due to the increase in extreme rainfall events. And the report warns that mold could be one of the most devastating long-term hidden costs of man-made climate change, which is increasing humidity, rainfall, and storminess.
Well, the scientists never warned us about mold, now did they?
In Pakistan, 17% of the country is still flooded, 2 months after persistent torrential rainfall triggered catastrophic flooding that submerged a third of the nation over the summer, its worst climate-driven disaster in history. The floods killed more than 1,700 people and destroyed more than 1 million homes. Now the United Nations says the beleaguered country is battling a second wave of catastrophe with malnutrition, malaria, cholera, dengue, and other waterborne diseases. It's the opposite problem in southern Africa, where a prolonged extreme heat wave has caused blackouts in nearly every nation. In Namibia and Madagascar, triple-digit temperatures and years of drought have decimated crops. The United Nations warns that Somalia and other impoverished African countries are on the verge of famine. Now, a new joint report released on Monday by the United Nations and the International Red Cross warns that these extremes are foreshadowing. If governments fail to cut emissions that cause global warming, the report warns that within decades, extreme heat waves will render some regions uninhabitable beginning around 2050. Areas predicted to, quote, exceed human physiological and social limits include the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, and South Asia.
It'll be fun in a couple of decades to look back on all of these warnings and wonder where we went wrong.
Extreme weather records are piling up, supercharged by man-made climate change. Australia's largest city, Sydney, has just clinched its wettest year on record since record-keeping began in the mid-1800s. It shattered its previous annual rainfall record with 3 months still to go in the rainy season, which has already triggered widespread flooding across New South Wales. But some good news.
It includes a target of zero new extinctions.
Australia has announced it will set aside at least 30% of its land mass for protection of endangered species in a bid to protect the nation's iconic animals and plants, species found nowhere else in the world, like koalas and kangaroos. According to a report published in July, Australia has lost more mammal species than any other continent.
Did she say the goal is zero new extinctions?
Yes.
Okay, then.
And finally, in California, the state's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has called a special session of the state legislature to weigh enacting a windfall profit tax on oil companies. Gas prices have climbed sharply in the last few weeks in California for no apparent reason, while staying steady or declining elsewhere. State regulators have asked refineries to explain why. Here's Governor Newsom.
The fact is, they're ripping you off. Their record profits are coming at your expense. And that's why today I'm calling for a windfall tax to ensure these profits go directly back to help millions of Californians who are paying for this oil company extortion.
You know who I wish would explain themselves is every single Republican in the House that voted against a law banning price gouging by big oil. Although they don't need to explain it, I think we know why they did it.
The only question is, will they be held accountable for it?
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com, as we continue our Working Class Heroes radio tour. We stop here in Chicago, broadcasting out of the studios here at WCPT AM 820, one of our radio affiliates. I want to thank the good folks here for having us. What a fantastic facility. But I'm excited about my next guest because you love him. You know him. He's the guy who helps bring you Labor History in 2 every day here on the program and on stations across the country. My good friend Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society. Larry, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, hi, Rick. It's good to talk to you again.
So let's start with that first. I mean, the Labor History in 2 segments have been so popular. It's on about 70 stations across the country. It's one of these things that I keep saying, we've got to remember the history. We've got to remind people of where the working class struggles were, the people who fought, bled, and died for it. And right here in Chicago, where I would argue labor history kind of began.
Well, that's something that we say here at the Illinois Labor History Society, as do historians and many other people. While that can be argued where it began, what you can say about Chicago is that it was an epicenter of labor activity going in the 19th century for a variety of reasons, which include where Chicago is situated and the location, the geography, but also, of course, the settling of the beginning of much industrialization that moved from out east to the Midwest in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, now we're on this Working Class Heroes radio tour, and you're going to places where manufacturing jobs were the heart of the community. It's what built the most prosperous working class in history. And I think, people pine for the days, when unions were strong, when manufacturing was pumping, the life security, the opportunities that people got. But I think we forget that those manufacturing jobs, those steel mill jobs, those mining jobs, those weren't good jobs until they were union jobs. And I think we're in a moment where kind of remembering that is important.
Well, certainly it has come to the forefront of the nation's consciousness, I think, especially since the pandemic, as people were reevaluating the nature of work itself and realizing that now in industries that may not be heavy industry, although warehouse work is very difficult, where people are beginning to organize, frontline workers in healthcare have incredibly difficult jobs, not dissimilar in many ways to dangerous industrial jobs, the kinds of hazards that people face. Obviously, there are other gig workers that are unorganized and are beginning to organize. But the notion that the unionization takes place only where there is manufacturing is now a myth. In fact, most unionization is outside of manufacturing, although the highest density of unionization outside the public sector still takes place among energy workers and heavy, large industrial arenas.
Yeah, I'm hoping we get back to a day when you have insurance agents who are in unions, waiters and waitresses in unions, like we've had in the past, right?
Sure. I mean, I still have a little book that the bartenders union sold that they gave to their members on making drinks, so the bartenders were organized and the hairdressers, and you could go on and on about all the what we might call a small individual skilled worker, small craft individual skilled workers who belonged to unions back, especially during that period after World War II.
Now, we've just come out of Scranton, Pennsylvania here recently, and we took a coal mine tour. And what I found very interesting is while we were taking this tour, and this mine that we were in was, working, the late 1800s into the early 1900s. And, the guy who was giving the tour was talking about how horrible the working conditions were, how the animals were treated better than the people, how children had a 50% fatality rate, the little nipper boys, and how, the conditions were just horrible. There was, filth and muck and, you name it. It was just a treacherous, dangerous, horrible place. And one of the women in the group, and look, bless her soul, but she goes, well, where was OSHA? And it was kind of one of these things, those head slap moments where people think that what we have today was always what we've had, and not understanding what it took to get those kind of things, which is why I think it's so important that you help us produce those Labor History and Twos that go out every day for people to kind of remember and maybe learn about things that they didn't when they were in school.
My experience is that, and this is more with people who are already organized, but maybe not active, when they learn history, it encourages them, it inspires them to want to be active in their union and to take a greater role, because they say, nobody ever taught me this. How come I never learned this? Certainly that's true of the general public who become aware of these significant historical labor history events through programs and other things that, for instance, that we provide. But it is especially among people who already have access to an organization but didn't realize that that organization's history is what gave them the benefits that they now enjoy. So it's, it is absolutely a reminder, a facilitator for labor history is for helping people reach another level, which is to be active, to contribute towards the union that they're in or the association that they're in, because that's in fact how we've succeeded in the past.
And you're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, the good folks who help us put out and produce our labor history in two segments. You can find that at our website, thericksmithshow.com. There's a box there. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to our podcast. You can make sure that you get those and share them with your friends. A little daily 2 minutes of labor history, a little education, a little thought, put in the head and make sure you share with your friends. But, you know, we're here in Chicago, home of the eight-hour day. And I was talking with someone the other day who was saying, you know, we don't need those eight-hour day laws anymore. We don't need that stuff because work is different. This is a brilliant argument. You know, back in the old days, Larry, work was difficult. It was manual. It was menial. And we were protecting people from the bosses being, you know, tyrannical. And now things are, well, we sit on the couch and, you know, tap away at our keyboards. So we don't need those protections anymore. What do you say to an argument like that?
You know, the dignity that we sometimes say is part of all work is taken out of work when people are forced or expected to work beyond a reasonable mean. And the 8-hour day is an arbitrary number. That was picked back in the mid-19th century as 8-hour day because people were working 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And 8-hour day, you know, the slogan, 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours for what you will, was a way to look at it in the day in three parts. But that, again, is arbitrary and socially constructed, 8 hours. Why 8 hours working as a nurse is an incredibly difficult job, and they usually work 12-hour shifts. It's again, arbitrary. And what we do know is that people are more productive when they can work shorter hours and produce the same amount, which is more likely when they don't have to work 8 hours. But, you know, the other side of it is that there are so many workers now who have to cobble together jobs to even get 8 hours. So yep. They might work two jobs because of all the part-time contingent workforce in this country. So the nature of the 8-hour day, on one hand, is arbitrary. It was a very progressive movement to get it to be an 8-hour day that took, you know, decades and decades to get the laws, Fair Labor Standard Act and things like that passed. But it's there's no... divine reason that work should be 8 hours.
Yeah, but here's the thing that gets me, and this is where my mind went with this person. I'm going, you know, it's amazing how quickly and how easily we're willing to give up what people fought, bled, and literally died for. And here in Chicago, really the birthplace of the 8-hour day, and you can talk much more eloquently about this than I can. It's amazing to me that people are willing to go, well, you know, that was something we needed back then, but we're better than that now. We don't need it. And I'm often, you know, dumbstruck at how easy we're willing to negotiate away hard fought battles of the past.
That's, the greatest driving force on policy changes regarding work tend to come from the profiteers. The corporate agenda sort of rules all of that. And what unions do, of course, is try to mediate and fight against those kinds of abuses, that the drive for profit that means more hours, less pay, more hours, less pay, or less hours, no benefits, less hours, no benefits. It all comes around to the same thing. So, it is unfortunate that people lose sight of these things, don't know where it comes from. And when they, as we talked just a few minutes ago, when they do, they become a little more inspired. Work is very, very difficult, 8 hours in a day in many, many jobs, especially jobs where people have less control over less autonomy, less control over the decision making. You know, it may be one thing for a coder who has the flexibility, or today a lot of professional workers who can kind of set their own hours, although many of them work unreasonable amounts of hours because they can never turn it off. But most workers are still in a job where they have to be available every moment, all the time, for a period given of time. And it's stressful, it's difficult, and this isn't about people shouldn't have to work hard to do a good job. It's about what's a reasonable social understanding of what makes a better quality of life for everybody. Some countries already in Scandinavia are experimenting with shorter days. This has been talked about in certain European countries, such as Germany, for years. It's not an easy question to resolve, but you know, the fight for the eight-hour day began after the Civil War and quickly headed to Chicago and culminating the Haymarket event that we celebrate all around the world as International Labor Day. But again, we should always be thinking about whether the way we organize work should be the way it was for the last 50 years. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
Be better, be different.
No, we want it better. But, you know, the thing is, you know, we were talking about a shorter work day in this country, too, for a very short period of time. Back in the mid-1950s, there was some talk about a six-hour work day. In fact, you could go back to during the Depression when Kellogg's went to a six-hour day to ensure that workers, you know, I'm not saying the Kellogg Company was a great company and all that, but, you know, they kept people working during that time period. And it's something that we should be talking about it every time a recession hits, every time there's an economic downturn. So working people don't get completely screwed every time the capitalists screw up our economy.
Yeah. I think the other myth that exists is people, again, I use the term the corporate agenda, which drives a lot of the consciousness of how people think, because that's determined what is presented, you know, whether it's in the news or now, of course, you know, through internet-based news and digital media, et cetera, social media. But one thing that has not changed, if you go back the last 50 years when wages have declined in America or been stagnant, I should say stagnant for the last 50 years, 40 years for sure, is that corporate America profits have continued to go up. It doesn't mean that certain companies don't fail. And of course, certain companies fail. But the truth is that the rich got richer. This is a cliche that we hear about all the time. The one percenters, the rich are richer than ever, continue to profit for the last 40 years in ways that the other vast majority, 70% to 80% of the workforce's wages are stagnant. It doesn't even make sense. And so productivity has been up during that whole period of time. So clearly we can rethink this idea of how many hours we work. Why not work 7-hour day or a 6-hour day and employ more people? You know, but the profit motive is so powerful and all consuming that if which determines these sorts of things, unless you have a very powerful institution or institutions or collective action to put a stopgap against some of those abuses.
Yeah, no, I get it from the corporate side. I get it from the CEO side. They want cheap labor. They want exploitable environmental rules. They want deregulation. I get that. But we the working people, we outnumber them. While they have all the money, we've out-procreated them. If we were united, if we were marching in the same direction, shoulder to shoulder, I think things might be a little bit differently, and we'd be having a different conversation. You know, one that would say, you know, should work be our life and our only part of our life, or should be what helps us fund our life? And the old frame of, you know, do I live to work or work to live? And I think you know, the railroad, you know, potential strike at the railroad was a huge part of that conversation.
Well, absolutely, because the railroad workers were working, especially since the pandemic, ridiculous amounts of hours. This whole idea of what is the amount of work that one should work is something that has existed, you know, 150 years. People have been talking about this. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours, what we will. But, you know, a lot of people engaged in philosophical and social ideals would talk about why we have more time for ourselves, that we can make a better society because people can contribute to civic society. And as we all know, most people come home after 8 hours a day, which includes which really becomes a 10-hour day on average for people because of commuting and getting ready for work and everything else. By the time you've spent 8 to 11, 12 hours a day, your ability to participate in the other world of civic society is less and less. And yep. So that world now becomes dominated by a handful of people who feel that, well, I have a job that has flexibility. You know, if you look at people who are in library boards, people who are on village boards and, you know, things like that, or even commissions and communities, those often are people who have flexible work, who have the ability to determine their own schedule. And that's where it separates the average workforce from others. And those are the kinds of things that suggest why we should have a shorter workday.
No, that's an excellent point. Now, you know, obviously, as we've been talking about, and you're listening to the Rick Smith Show, we're here with Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, the folks who help us get you labor history into every day. You look at, you know, this being the area that brought the eight-hour workday to the forefront. Now, one of the pieces of legislation that's being pushed, an amendment to your Constitution to make sure that the Workers' Rights Amendment, to make sure that people's ability to join and form unions is in your Constitution. Could this be the beginning of another cycle of Chicago leading the way in labor rights and labor reform?
Well, certainly Illinois. And when we talk about, you know, we love to talk about Chicago, but it is an Illinois amendment and hopefully could be a model for other states in the country to start doing this. Essentially, what this is, this workers' rights amendment does is it's kind of like taking the National Labor Relations Act that's been gutted from by 1947. And strengthening workers' ability to collectively bargain, not have to worry about right-to-work laws, which we know are right-to-work-for-less laws, and guarantee some of those ideas that will help it make it easier to organize across the state. So, yes, it could be a model for other states. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to pass, because it needs 60%, and there's always low turnout in midterm elections. And what is most amazing, you can always tell the power of an idea by how it's opposed. And the billionaires are pouring tons and tons of money through their many front organizations, their fake newspapers. I hate using the word fake news because it was always used by the right wing, but, you know, they've created newspapers. AFSCME members in Illinois are getting mailings from the various right to work committees that come in different forms, which are funded by Richard Uihlein and Ken Griffin and all, you know, the Liberty Center and Americans for Prosperity. It goes on and on and on. Why are they going to pump more than $100 million to try to defeat this? I have already seen, I was driving downstate and I already saw poster, I think it was. It was about the amendment that says, defeat the amendment and keep our taxes low. So, you know, it doesn't even make sense. But
defeat the amendment and love puppies.
That's right. So, you know, but once again, it all goes back to the idea that this is corporate driven, even though there are a lot of individuals who may participate. Individuals who really don't understand what it's about, but follow the corporate agenda line. And that's what drives the anti-worker initiatives. You know, the Koch brothers fund all of this, as many of the other, I call it right wing, but pro-corporate lobby, you know, the Civic Club or the Commercial Club of Chicago. You could go on and on and on about the various organizations.
Yeah.
But they have the real money.
Now, I go back to something my grandfather always said. He said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And this seems like that perfect situation, because they're taking $100 million out of their pocket to tell working people that they don't need something. This is one of those moments where if that's the message, they're spending all this time, money, effort telling us we don't need something we absolutely need.
Yeah, and that's, of course, you know, we workers who are organized know this experience, especially those who are active in unions, and how companies will spend more money to keep a union from getting a contract or being able to organize that would be if they just paid them wage increases.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You know, the idea that, yeah, so, you know, it all goes back to power, control, and profit.
It is incredible what they do. But Larry, I appreciate you taking some time for us. It's always great to come to Chicago and get with you. Your wealth of knowledge. I hope folks will take a look at what you guys at the Illinois Labor History Society do. And of course, thank you for the help with the labor history and too. We love having them and we love having you. Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society. If you want to hear, got some questions, want to hear some thoughts, email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Real quick, want to point you in the direction of the Illinois Labor History Society, illinoislaborhistory.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can check out the work that they do there. And of course, they're the folks who helped us put together the labor history in two. And the reason I think it's so important that we continue to educate, inform, enlighten, engage, and talk about the past is because, look, it's coming back around. All of the horrible things that have happened in the past, there are those, look at our Supreme Court, wanting to revive that horrible. I think we're marching right back to the days of Lochner, the Lochner era, where if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work in poverty conditions for desperation wages, hey, that's your liberty. That's your freedom, which is why I hope you'll check out illinoislaborhistory.org for the work that they do. And of course, our Labor History in Two segments, always there, always available. You can get that at thericksmithshow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day 33 Chilean miners were finally pulled to safety after being trapped for 69 days. Workers had been mining copper and gold 2,300 feet down at the San Jose mine near the northern city of Copiapo when the mine caved in early August. The company waited several hours to notify authorities, and rescue efforts only began 2 days later. Trapped miners initially tried to escape through ventilation shafts, but found the required ladders missing. Each route they attempted was blocked by fallen rock or threatened additional collapse. A state-owned mining company took over the rescue efforts, and soon they began. As geologist Serena Sorensen noted, prospecting for people. Initial exploratory boreholes failed to locate miners because mineshaft maps had never been updated. Rescuers had no idea whether miners were even still alive. Finally, 17 days later, the eighth borehole reached them. The miners tapped on the drill and taped notes to it, alerting rescuers above that they were indeed alive and well. Food, medicine, and other supplies were lowered down to them as rescue efforts intensified. Mini cameras were also lowered down, and miners videotaped messages of their continued ordeal. They told how they continued to search for possible escape routes and agreed to ration their limited food supplies so they could all survive. The first of three drilling plans to free the miners began. It was an international effort. The Chilean Navy consulted with NASA to design and construct the rescue pods. Throughout the entire process, rescuers worked to prevent additional cave-ins and rock falls. Finally, the extraction process began, and in less than 48 hours, all miners emerged as heroes.
The problem with our so-called free market is that it's not free for you and me. It's largely controlled by monopolies, which are free to inflate prices just because they can, letting gougers gleefully extract unwarranted monopoly profits from us. This milking of consumers by tightly consolidated industries is propelling today's surging price hikes. Brand name corporations claim they're being forced to mark up price tags just to cover rising costs for raw materials, labor, transportation, etc. But in a competitive marketplace, they'd have to eat much of those increases by taking a bit less in profits. Indeed, monopolies are now raising prices simply to squeeze even greater profits from hard-hit consumers, a game of corporate greed that socks America with more inflation. Consider diapers. A year ago, Procter & Gamble announced that the pandemic was driving up its production costs, forcing it to raise prices for its Pampers brand. At the time, it had just posted a quarterly profit of $3.8 billion, so P&G could easily have absorbed a temporary rise in its costs. But instead of holding the price to ease their customers' economic pain, the conglomerate used a global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. And in that same quarter, P&G spent $3 billion to buy back shares of its own stock, a Wall Street manipulation that artificially bloats the wealth of top executives and other big shareholders. In short, P&G used the excuse of inflation to inflate the price of their diapers, then used the extra money it extracted to inflate the value of its stock to benefit rich shareholders. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, couldn't consumers just switch to Huggies, the brand sold by P&G's main competitor? No, for it's a co-monopolist, having also goosed up its prices.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So you may remember a couple of days ago on the program, we were talking about our experience up in Scranton. We took the tour at the Lackawanna coal mine. And again, you know, we forget how dangerous, how horrible working conditions used to be. We forget that work used to be poverty-level work, that employers really super cheated people, even though still going on, wage theft, one of the biggest crimes in our country right now. But we do it in a much nicer way. No longer do you come home and find the dead body of a loved one as your eviction notice. No more do you find that you have to send your children into the mines or into the mills just to put food on the table. We're a little bit more civilized. Question is how much more? And that's why I reached back and asked John Pesta to come talk with us. John was the tour guide and a fabulous tour guide. And if you're ever in the Scranton area, you have to take this tour and you have to ask for John to do that. But John Pesta, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
So, you know, how long have you been doing these tours? Because I got to tell you, I'm not blowing smoke. You were fabulous.
Thank you. I've been doing it since 2015.
And what made you get into this?
My brother worked there before me on the weekends, and just to keep the history alive. I mean, in my retirement, it was something to do, and it really was an eye-opening experience. I mean, I knew, that my father was a miner, but he died when I was 8 years old, and after he died, we sort of lost touch with my father's side of the family, and it was more like my mother's side. So when I started working up there and started doing some research, I mean, I just learned an awful lot about my own family. Things that even my oldest living brothers sometimes just didn't want to recount, you know. I realized how lucky I was being the youngest of my father's children and coming along when I did. Even though we were poor, I didn't know we were poor, and I certainly didn't live in the conditions that my older two brothers grew up in or spent their early childhood in, I should say. Even though it was the 40s, that area of the Wyoming Valley here in Pennsylvania was still very backward and still very much a coal community. And my father had only gone to third grade. When he divorced his first wife, he got custody of my two brothers, and they would have to read to him, you know, the grocery bill and things like that, because he only went to third grade before he went to work in the mines.
That's incredible. And again, you know, we think back and go, wow, that was so long ago. It really wasn't that long ago. As you've pointed out, it's one person's lifetime.
That's exactly right.
You know, I remember when I first moved to Pennsylvania, I met a guy who said when he came back from Vietnam,
They gave him a little bit of money, and he paid his family's debt to the company store, basically. And he said it was the first time in 100 years that his family had not been in debt to this particular company, because it was the coal company, and